from KQED.
Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. It's hard to forget Aurora, Colorado, Oikos College in Oakland, Gabby Gifford in Tucson, the Sikh Temple in Wisconsin, and Virginia Tech University. But we do forget, much more quickly than we imagine at the time. All the above cases were of mass murder, right here in the USA. What do these horrible events have in common, and what, if anything, can be done to prevent them? We have a panel of experts who've been looking at these problems for some time and have some insights, and you can join the discussion. Forum is next, right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. This morning, trying to make sense, if that's the right word, of the recent spate of mass killings that have happened in Wisconsin, Oakland, Tucson, Aurora, Colorado, and Virginia Tech. Did I leave any out? Probably. It seems like an epidemic, but is it? Lots of questions arise. Could better psychological care or identification have prevented any of these murders? What did the killers have in common? How could the authorities have handled the situations differently? What about guns, though that's a subject unto itself and riddled with politics? In any case, we'll tackle some of those tough issues this hour with a panel of people who have been studying and thinking about these cases for a long time. So with us this morning are David Cullen. Good morning to you, David Cullen.
Hi.
Hi. He's the author of Columbine, a book that was very popular a year or so ago. And he's a contributor for the New York Times and Newsweek, the Washington Post, and other publications. And he's written extensively on this whole issue. Ellen Servillon is the nursing director of Oikos University, and she was one of Onne Goh's teacher, and she'll be with us in a little while. David Eagleman is on the phone with us from Houston, Texas. He's a neuroscientist and director of the Initiative of Neuroscience and the Law at the Baylor College of Medicine. And he's the author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. So, David Eagleman, thanks very much for being with us. And here in the studio, Karen Franklin is a forensic psychologist at the California School of Professional Psychology in San Francisco. She's a teacher. And we may have a few other folks joining us along the way. But let's get to the subject at hand. David Cullen, I'd like to start with you. You've kind of analyzed this whole situation with mass murder and come up with three kinds of people who make these murders. Maybe you could start by telling us about that.
Sure. Well, that's limiting things to these these large-scale mass murders, the puzzling ones. So that's sort of ruling out terrorism because we know what that is. Of the remaining ones, a remarkably large number of them fall into one of three categories. The first is a clinical psychopath, and that means in the clinical sense of that term, and not popular or movie version of it, but somebody with no empathy, no regard for others, just cold-blooded, rational killer who knows exactly what he's doing, is not mentally ill, just has no empathy and doesn't care. That's one type. The second type is somebody who is deeply mentally ill, often schizophrenic or other related psychoses, but somebody who's deeply delusional and out of touch with reality, who really sort of doesn't understand reality as we know it. That's actually remarkably rare, although we've had a couple prominent cases. Tucson was apparently a case like that, and Virginia Tech definitely was. And the assassination of Reagan, Hinckley was. But those are really, really the exceptions, so we don't want to demonize those people. And the third type is actually what turns out to be the most common, what most people don't expect, but deeply depressed people, suicidally depressed, angry depressives who get to the point after usually years of spiraling down, get to the point where they don't know what to do anymore, helplessness and hopelessness, where they start lashing out at other people and sort of irrationally lash out. And that tends to be the bulk.
the case that you spent the most time on, which was Columbine,
sure.
The two perpetrators there, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, fall into two of those categories, right?
Exactly. I mean, the biggest mistake people make with Columbine is constantly asking, oh, why did they do it? As if there's a single they, as if there were one person. And usually in the case of two shooters, you have this duality where they're not looking for somebody like them. They're each sort of like in search of a complementary person, filling some needs they don't have. And in that case, Eric Harris, who was kind of the mastermind of it, was definitely deeply psychopathic. He was a cruel, sadistic psychopath. And then Dylan Klebold was a really, really deeply sad, beyond sad, I'm sorry I shouldn't use that word, but deeply, deeply depressed kid, who kept a journal and for 2 years kept a journal in the very first entry, talked about suicide. And, right. So he was deeply down for a long time.
All right, so I want to get into more about that in a minute. I want to know if knowing those categories actually helps us. But let's turn to David Eagleman for a minute in Houston, neuroscientist and director of the Initiative of Neuroscience and the Law at Baylor. Dr. Eagleman, do you more or less go along with David Cullen's categorization?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact is that when somebody ends up in front of the judge's bench, there are so many different reasons why someone can get there. As David said, there's sociopathy, there's psychosis. One thing he didn't mention is brain tumors, which sometimes happens, and with our improving technology, we're going to be able to discover that more and more. Many people will remember the case of Charles Whitman, who in 1966 climbed up to the top of the tower at the University of Texas in Austin, and he started randomly killing people, and he killed 39 people. It turned out upon autopsy he had a brain tumor, and he had been recognizing that something had been changing inside of him for the previous year. He had written about it in his diary. He'd gone to see a psychiatrist to seek help, but nothing was able to be done at that time. And what we know is that brain tumors can change behavior in drastic ways. Now, I think probably this is a very rare instance, and most of the time when we see mass shootings, it won't be that. But it's worth mentioning, and also it's worth mentioning drugs, and generally impulse control problems. So people, when they get damage to, for example, their frontal lobes, which can happen, for example, with traumatic brain injury, sometimes they can understand very well the difference between right and wrong, but they've lost the brakes to their engine, and they can't control their behavior anymore. So in total, there are lots and lots of different things that can happen with brains that all lead them to this sort of behavior. And of course, there's I think Dave alluded to this briefly too, which is that sometimes it can be multiple things going on in the same person. There's often drugs involved, as well as depression, as well as something in their background, as well as impulse control problems.
But I think we have to make a very strong point here that there are lots of psychopaths, there are lots of mentally ill people, there are probably more depressive people, there are people with brain tumors. And 99.9% of them do not commit mass murder.
That's exactly right. And this is one of the prime difficulties is in this issue of prediction. Every time something like this happens, people say, well, what can we do to measure everybody's brain or measure them as far as a psychological profile and tell who's going to do this next? And the fact is that, thankfully, the numbers on this are so low that we have a very small sample size. And when you sort of average everyone together and we figure out, okay, these are the things they had in common, what you get is a profile that fits millions of young people
right.
who are depressed or have bad backgrounds or on drugs and so on. And so we find ourselves in a situation where we can't actually say too much going forward before someone has committed a crime.
Now, I want to take a case in point. With us on the phone, excuse me, is Ellen Servillon, who is the nursing director at Oikos University, where One Goa was one of her pupils. Ms. Servillon, you actually knew him, and he's the person who ended up killing five people, I think.
It was six students.
Secretary. Right. What it in the context of what we're talking about, trying to figure out if somebody fits into one of these categories and might be dangerous, what was your experience with Oneg?
Was one girl. He basically was a loner. He sat by himself. He didn't communicate too much with the other students, even though the students said that he went out to lunch with them a lot. But and he would pay too. But he was he didn't study with them, it seems, and he didn't group with them. A lot of nursing students get together and study together and work together, and because it's very intense type of and training. So they use each other to help each other. And he just seemed to be off to the side all the time.
Did you get any indication that he might be, I don't know what the word is, going off, dangerous, whatever?
I didn't see anything, and none of the other instructors said anything about it. The students said that, you know, he just sometimes would snap a little bit, you know, when he was making conversation with them. But that was the only clue. They seemed to have a little bit more into it than we did. He didn't show up anything, but yet he came in. And the end of the program, the middle of the program, actually, of the medical surgical nursing, the end of November last year, he decided just to quit all of a sudden. He was one of my best students. He was my second highest student. And he decided just to leave the program. And he was halfway through. And usually when a student does that, I talk to him and say, you know, is there a problem? You know, maybe you want to take a leave of absence or something. And he just wanted to leave. He just didn't want any more part of it.
Seemed depressed to you?
I think so. I think he was more depressed. You know, I understand now, you know, why. Because he had issues with his father who's still alive, but his mother passed and a brother passed. And we didn't know any of that. You know, they don't mention these things. We can't ask. You know, we have to be very careful because it's discriminatory if we start asking, you know,
right.
What's the problem? What do you mean? You know, why are you doing this? That kind of stuff.
That's an interesting point that you bring up. Sometimes the rules make it difficult. Karen Franklin is a forensic psychologist at the California School of Professional Psychology. So you've been hearing all this. Let's move in the direction of, you know, what do you do about it? And the other thing that no one's mentioned is identifying these folks. What do you feel about what we've been talking about here?
Good morning. I think that the Oikos example that the nursing instructor just gave is a perfect example of how we cannot really predict who is going to go off in this way. It is so exceedingly rare. I mean, there's about 20 of these per year in the United States, and we've got a nation of more than 311 million people. And there's such a variety, as the other experts have mentioned, of types of people who can go on to do this. I think hindsight is 2020. There's a great deal of hindsight bias in looking at people after the fact and saying, oh, they gave off this signal or this clue or they fit into this type. But I think the agency that's most studied this phenomenon has been the Secret Service in the context of assassins, which is slightly different. But what they found is that about a quarter of the assassins and would-be assassins have mental illnesses. However, mental illness is something of a red herring. It doesn't really predict anything because the mentally ill and the non-mentally ill killers essentially have the same sets of motivations, and there's several different motivations.
And mental illness can mean a lot of things.
Mental illness.
It doesn't just mean schizophrenia or whatever. There's a lot of mental illnesses.
It explains virtually nothing. In fact, it's kind of a circular way of looking at it because we can say, oh, they were mentally ill, they were depressed, they were suicidal, they were schizophrenic, delusional, what have you. It doesn't really tell us why. What was their motivation? So the motivations that for example, the Secret Service has come up with is And these will fit in the public's imagination with the cases that are recently in the news include revenge, a goal of notoriety, which may have been the case for the Aurora massacre suspect, James Holmes, an end to pain, overwhelming pain in the case of suicidal depression, and then finally acting for a righteous cause, such as perhaps the killer of the Sikhs at the temple in Milwaukee.
The white supremacist.
Right.
And so there's usually some sort of backstory, obviously. But where does it get us? And I'm going to bring in an example that I've dealt with after one of these shootings, after the Loeffner shooting. I talked to a young man at a high school in San Francisco who had been diagnosed as schizophrenic, but he had been identified early. He had listened to voices in his head that were telling him to do bad things. He had gotten help, and he's now in college and doing pretty well. He wasn't even on medication at the time, but he was diagnosed. This came in a program run by the one of the San Francisco agencies, and it was supported by money from a proposition called Prop 63 in California, where money was meant to do early intervention. Now, does that make any sense? I mean, everything that I've read here says, boy, we can analyze this stuff into the ground, but it's pretty hard to figure out how to stop it. I don't know, Dave Cullen, maybe you can comment on that.
Well, yes, I got several thoughts. I definitely want to agree and amplify what a couple of the other guests said about it being nearly impossible to predict these people. And the FBI also did a really wonderful report by Mary Ellen O'Toole, a profiler, after Columbine, where they studied a huge number of cases of school shootings and worked for a couple of years on this report. And it was called, I believe, School Shooters, a Threat Assessment Perspective, and where they try to give guidance to teachers, administrators, and parents and so forth on how to predict these kids. And there's about three different criteria you need to look through. It goes on for several dozen pages, and it's just it's a really, really well-researched report. But I mean, the bottom line is, you read it, you almost want to throw your hands up. Is that, you know, God, this is, as I think David said, you know, this is describing millions of people. You know, it's really not narrowing it down, and it's not because the FBI did a poor job. It's because there's no narrowing this down. There are so many, I mean, you can think of them as false positives, but there's so many people who fit the bill, and only a tiny fraction of the percentage will do it. And excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. But the thing is, that can lead to frustration, but I think it's really more an issue of, like, we need to try to approach it differently. If you try to look at the situation and say, okay, how can we find all the little needles in the haystack, you know, the 20 people a year who your guest referred to who are going to do this, well, that's never going to happen. We're never going to go one by one and, you know, have every school and every parent looking for this guy who may be, you know, grabbing a gun. That's not going to happen. We really can't tell. We don't have that kind of, you know, sort of minority report thing where we can predict it. But what we can do is, there are big things that we can do, which work on the bigger picture. And especially when we consider that, you know, the biggest chunk of these people are deep depressives, and another big chunk are the mentally ill. Well, we're doing a pretty poor job in both of those areas in this country. And if we address both of those areas, we'll sort of globally improve the picture. And
well, that's the big question, of course, as to whether we will. You've been listening to Dave Cullen, by the way, who's the author of Columbine and a contributor to the New York Times and Newsweek and so forth. Dave Eagleman, I'd like you to comment on this, though. I mean, it sounds like we need a new approach, but it also sounds like nobody knows what approach is going to work.
Well, there are a few points to be made here. One of them is, even though it's very difficult before someone has committed a crime to know if they're likely to do it, many listeners will be familiar with the research that's going on about prediction of future recidivism. In other words, how likely is somebody to do something again? And this is a very rich field of study. And sometimes people are surprised that there are pretty good, essentially, actuarial tables that say, hey, this guy's really dangerous, we should sentence him for longer. This guy over here is not so dangerous, we don't need to sentence him for the same length. Sometimes people are surprised that those actuarial tables exist, but that you can't do it in advance of something happening. And the reason is, one of the best predictors of crime
is if you have committed a crime before. In other words, once you've committed a crime, then we know a lot about you statistically. The difficulty comes with these with people who have never done anything, like James Holmes, who had a perfectly clean record. Then it's just really difficult. We don't have the statistical power for it.
Holmes is the was the shooter in Aurora, Colorado, at the movie theater.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I just want to mention another point, which is very important, because you brought up earlier about a young person who was diagnosed with schizophrenia and helped and so on. But most people with mental illness do not behave violently. And if you look across all the violent behavior, you find that it's only about 4% of violent behavior is committed by people with mental illness. The general story is that you're safer in a mental health institution than you are out on the street. And so, even though we can work harder at early identification, and this is very important for lots of humanitarian reasons to do this, that's not necessarily going to solve the overall problem of these very rare events.
Karen Franklin wanted to get in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple things. Well, one, I want to disagree real strongly with Dr. Eagleman about the efficacy of actuarial tables. They're only slightly better than the flip of a coin, and there's newer and better research coming out on our race to endorse those as a method for predicting future violence and sexual offending also by individuals who have been in the criminal justice system already. They're not as good as they're being promoted to be. But one thing, I think there is more promise than we realize. And I think a lot of the threat assessment teams that are being formed, for example, in the wake of the Virginia Tech shooting, are focusing not so much on predicting the future. And I think that is, we all agree, that's pretty hopeless. But rather on intervening when there is a perceived problem. And a lot of people give off clues. It's not necessarily that they're going to become mass shooters, but they're troubled and they may cause some problems. There are lots of things that can be done without predicting whether they're going to go on to become very dangerous, such as mediation, conflict resolution, getting them into therapy, the example that you gave.
Well, when somebody actually says, I've had hallucinations and I've heard voices that say I should do something bad, I should kill somebody, that's kind of a good clue, isn't it?
Well, it seems that way on the surface, but the problem is one of the base rate. What's the base rate of these kinds of fantasies versus the base rate of actually acting out on them? And so many people have violent fantasies, and so few of those people actually go on to act them out. As Dr. Eagleman said, there are cases where people have frontal lobe impairment or brain tumors. These people are more likely to act out their violent fantasies. But in general, I think it's a really dangerous approach to look at fantasies, even violent drawings of high school kids, and to assume that they're at really high risk to go out and do something.
All right. Well, it's a tough subject, and we will continue on it in a minute. We've been talking with Dave Cullen, who's the author of Columbine and who writes for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so forth, with Dave Eagleman, who's with us from Houston, the Baylor School of Medicine, neuroscientist and director of the Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law, and Karen Franklin, who is a forensic psychologist at the California School of Professional Psychology. They're going to stick around with us for a little while. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Spencer Michael, sitting in for Michael Krasny, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny, and we are talking this hour about mass murder and the people who commit it and what we can learn about them. And we've got several people with us in the studio and on the phone, and we'll talk to them, and I'll introduce them as we get to them. First, a comment that we got on the web already, and you can join us, by the way. With the economy being what it is and depression high among young males, it concerns me that in each of these recent cases and the shooting in Arizona where the Congresswoman Gabby Giffords was shot and disabled and others being killed, all the young men were known to have mental health issues, yet no one seemed to do anything serious to address the issue. Same with the young mentally ill man who stabbed a man in his yard in the East Bay. He was known to be mentally ill but allowed to run free and be a threat to innocent people. Okay, that's our comment for this hour. And let's talk to Brian Russell, who's joined us now. He's a forensic psychologist and an attorney, and he's based in Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome to Forum, Brian Russell. What do you think about this comment that all these people were mentally ill and nobody did anything about it?
Well, you know, it's one thing to identify that somebody has mental problems or instability. It's another thing altogether to intervene on that person if the person is resistant. And so it's a delicate balance that we have to strike from a public policy standpoint, because we're balancing people's constitutional rights to their individual liberty against our public safety. And it's difficult to force somebody who says that they are, you know, you can offer them all kinds of interventions, but if they say they don't want it, especially if they have an antisocial bend, they're angry, in addition to whatever mental illness issues they may have, to force them into anything, you know, you've got to have an imminent threat to self or others, or you've got to have a crime having been committed.
So you have to, do you have to prove that? I mean, that would be pretty tough to prove if, with any of these people who we've been talking about here, the killers.
Yeah, I mean, there is no, this is one of those things where there's no catch-all, but as with many societal problems, there are things that we can do to chip away at it incrementally. You know, it's like with Homeland Security. It starts with people who see something saying something. It starts with people learning to presume that threats are serious, to expect violence to escalate, to contact law enforcement as a first line of intervention when somebody posts threats online or threatens or gets violent with family, et cetera, because then we have a couple of opportunities as a society to intervene. One is there is such a thing as involuntary civil commitment, where we could take somebody into custody who's exhibiting clear signs of dangerousness to self or others. And, you know, that can help people sometimes and at least make it harder for them afterwards to buy guns legally, for example.
Well, have any of these,
have any of the people
we're talking about, though, the people who committed mass murder, any of them exhibited those signs where you could throw them into custody for a while, or were they all sort of surprises?
Well, no. Let's take Cho Sung-hui, for example, the shooter at Virginia Tech. This is a guy who had set a fire on campus. This is a guy who had stalked women on campus. And this is a guy who had actually ended up in front of a judge who had the choice to involuntarily commit him or to let him, as he ultimately fatefully did, go and check himself into treatment. And, you know, I can understand how the judge probably thought, well, I don't want to create a record for this kid. I don't want to ruin this kid's life with a record of involuntary commitment if he's willing to go into treatment voluntarily, so I'll let him do it. Well, the problem is Sung-hui checked himself right in and checked himself right out, and then he was able to go and purchase guns legally because when they did the background check, they didn't find any involuntary civil commitment on the record. So, you know, he could have gotten guns a different way, obviously, but we could have made it harder by not worrying about what kind of record we were creating for him and worrying more about public safety and going ahead and saying, we're not going to trust you to check yourself in. We're going to check you in because you've exhibited clear signs. You've committed crimes on your campus, and that's really our problem. And actually, out in California, it sounds like, you know, they're handling this right with this professor who had set some fires, and then they had booked him on that and released him on bond, and then come to find out that he's sent emails with all kinds of violent fantasies in him. And so they go back, and they revoke his bond, and they bring him in, put him back, he's back in custody now. And that's exactly what we should do. When somebody has committed a crime and gives us a golden opportunity to get them under some control and get them in front of a criminal court judge who has the power to do all kinds of things, hold them in jail without bail like they're doing with that guy, or remand them to the custody of a treatment facility, or if they're going to release them, at least do it with conditions and monitoring where we can exert some control over the person.
All
and
right,
that's
so,
really where I think we drop the ball way too often, is when they've actually committed a crime and we actually have a chance to intervene and exert some control, and we don't.
Okay,
we
but you yourself have brought up some of the problems with that, the civil rights issues. Karen Franklin, what do you think about these ideas about maybe locking up some people who have committed crimes who seem like a threat?
Well, again, I want to stress this base rate problem of 20 crimes out of 311 million people. Now, out of the five recent mass shootings that we're talking about, four of them were college students or former college students. So when we look at college students, there's a recent study of almost 100,000 college students. 16 out of 100 of these young people were so depressed that they had trouble functioning. 9% were actively suicidal, and 1 out of 100 had actually attempted suicide in the most recent year.
Had any of them committed crimes?
I don't know the answer to that. That wasn't a topic of the study, but I think that we're talking about a huge number of troubled young people, and I think it begs a larger question. Why are so many young people so depressed and so alienated and so angry? And if we could get to the root of what's happening on an environmental and social level that's causing that degree of potential time bombs, we would be better off than trying to label the individuals as psychopaths or what have you and target them.
Interesting thought. We want to get to some phone calls in a minute, but Dave Eagleman, how do you feel about this issue of identifying and then maybe locking up people who have committed crimes?
Truthfully, this is one of the great civil rights issues of our time, because when it comes to something like involuntary civil commitment, a decision has to be made. Do we think that this person is dangerous to himself or to others? And if we do, then we get to lock the person up. But the fact is, there are real constitutional concerns here if we get overeager with that. It means that then the government has the right to put people away in the absence of having done anything wrong, because the government suspects that there might be something wrong with them and they might be this, you know, one of these 20 out of 311 million people. And so there's a tension here as far as rights go, as far as balancing rights of the individual against the safety of society. And it is the case that we get it wrong sometimes, and it's tragic when we get it wrong and somebody who would have been better off being involuntarily committed is not. But we have to always weigh that against the flip side, against, you know, locking up lots of depressed young people under the very tiny chance that they might do something.
I'm beginning to think this is an insoluble problem, but we will keep working at it. Anne in Pacifica, hi, you're on forum.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'd like the guest to address socialization and maybe there's an interaction with mental illness. But mental illness is as common in females as males, and depression is actually more common. But murder is overwhelmingly committed by males, including mass murder. I think that one has to look at the fact that our society condones violence in men a lot more. Men are given messages that in some situations violence is good, for example, in the military or, you know, the hero of the movies who takes on the bad guys.
Why did you start your comment, though, by talking about socialization? I don't understand how that plays into this.
So far, the discussion has simply been about mental illness. And like I say, this is as common in females, particularly depression is certainly more common in females. So I cannot see that this is a simple case of mentally ill people.
I see. That's
but
interesting
the, there
point.
May be an interaction with the way males are socialized about how to deal with their problems.
Interesting thought. Thank you for your call. Dave Cullen, you want to try that one?
No, I don't really, I'm not an expert on that. I have a comment on the previous discussion, but if somebody wants to address
all
that.
Right, let Karen Franklin, she's got a thought on it. Go ahead, Karen.
I have a thought. I may not be right on this, but one theory that I have is that there's a certain level of entitlement that males have that females don't have in our society. And one commonality in a lot of these cases is the person has a certain level of esteem and expectations for their life. And then when that goes wrong, they feel very they feel this sense of entitlement and that they were wronged in a fundamental way that needs to be righted. And I'm not sure that women typically have that same sense about themselves in society.
So it sounds like that's a subject that ought to be looked at a little bit more.
I think so.
It's interesting.
I mean, I may be wrong about it, but that's
something. No, but I think Ann brings up an interesting point. All right, let's take a call from Greg in San Mateo. Or Craig, rather. Sorry.
Yes. I'm curious your guest thoughts about whether we're, in fact, behaving irrationally as a society in trying to predict these very rare events rather than addressing threats that are more common. When something very unusual happens, that we experience it as psychologically traumatic. When something more common happens, like dying in car crashes, that's not as psychologically traumatic. But so part of our response is to try to take these unpredictable things and say that they shouldn't happen and somehow try to predict when they're going to happen. And I think we may be doing what trauma survivors often do, is putting our effort in the wrong place rather than taking the more predictable, knowable threats. And let's do things about things like traffic accidents and drunk driving and things that we actually happen more often and we know how to predict better.
Interesting thought. Any comments here, David?
Well, go ahead. Sorry, which David?
I got two Davids. David Eagleman.
I agree with the caller, of course, that we do overrepresent events like this. And, you know, there's an old saying that there already is a law that can protect you from things like this, and that is the law of averages. These events are extraordinarily rare. That said, there is a deep value in understanding mental illness and the effects of drugs and brain tumors and depression and so on for much larger quality of life issues for millions of people. And that's probably where the real importance is in studying and understanding this.
Okay. All right. We'll take a call now from Elizabeth in Oakland. Elizabeth, hi. You're on Forum.
Hi. I had a question about males versus females. But before I ask my question, it's crystal clear to me that we need to increase the availability of psychiatric hospitalizations for, for just the general public, deeply depressed people. People are suicidal for years, schizophrenics where the family knows that the person is in deep trouble. And then my question was about the category of deeply depressed murderers. What is the ratio of males to females, and is it just truly depression, or are there other psychiatric diagnoses in an interplay there? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think Dave Cullen actually addressed that early, and I think it is almost all males. There are very few
females. All males. There are rare cases. There was the woman in Alabama, the faculty member, a couple of years ago who opened fire during the faculty meeting. They're very uncommon. And in a joint study by the Secret Service and Department of Education on school shooters, so that's a slightly limited sample, but fairly representative, they studied, I believe, a 26-year period. Every single one, 100% were males. And I guess I will throw out a thought, and perhaps some of the other experts know more about this and can talk about it. But my understanding is that men commit most of the violent crime to begin with, and gun violence, bank robbery, so forth. I mean, it's part of a wider problem with men and aggressive behavior with men, and men are more aggressive. And whether that's nature or nurture, I don't think we can solve this today. But I think it should be no surprise that men doing most of these kinds of violent things are going to, you know, then be most of the violent murders, you know, the outliers on that whole list of violent crime.
Interesting thought.
Anyone want to correct me from or camera of the psychiatrists who know more about that?
Karen, you go along with that?
Yeah, I think men are the majority of violent criminals, not 100% like in the school shootings, but the majority. Can I make one quick comment on
Sure.
the psychiatric hospitalization
that
Elizabeth
point.
Brought up?
Yeah.
You know, it's fine to recommend greater access to care, and I think we would all agree on that. But in terms of involuntary civil commitment, as other guests have said, there's a civil rights issue. But beyond that, it's not necessarily effective. It's a stopgap at best because involuntary commitment is only for 72 hours in most cases without a judge renewing the hold. And most people who are involuntarily civilly committed can get together enough to behave in a way that they can get out within 72 hours. So it doesn't really stop anything. Might slow down a train if you really knew that the train was rolling, but it wouldn't necessarily prevent anything in the long run.
And the reason for putting somebody into a facility for 72 hours is that he or she is a danger to himself or others.
Yes.
That's the criteria.
Or gravely disabled, yes. There's three criteria, yes.
Yeah.
And that's hard. It's a high level. It's a high standard to prove. Many of these people would not meet it in the first place, and even if they did, it would only be a really short-term stopgap, and it might actually be counterproductive in increasing their anger rather than defusing them.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Nobody wants to be locked up against their will for something that they didn't do.
We make them angry, yeah. We have a couple of emails and comments here.
Something like that. Oh. It also makes them feel more threatened. You know, if you feel like the world is against you, if you're schizophrenic and you feel like people are, you know, doing things against you and then you get locked up, that sort of gives you validation that, like, oh, you know, they really are trying to do this. So, yeah.
Exactly.
And that whole feeling of you could call it paranoia if you want, is pretty common in the trend of things, it sounds like, David, right?
David.
Oh, which David? Can I make a wider comment about this? I want to agree with everything that Karen is saying, and I think we get a little off track when we talk about people who are mentally ill in one way or another, including depressives there, about locking them up versus getting them help. I think in general, involuntary treatment, as Karen was saying, is not going to solve our problem. The problem is that we need to address is the availability, is getting people help when they need it. And the good news is most of the people who are either depressives or, are deeply mentally ill or schizophrenic, those people want help. They desperately want help. Now, in any given situation, if they're schizophrenic, they might not want to go into a clinic. They might have fears and so forth. But bottom line, they feel like they're in trouble. They want help, and there are ways to get them help. We don't have to force them into it.
Some of them have been have gone for help and have not gotten it, right,
and been turned away. I mean, the case with Joe at Virginia Tech was classic. That he went in, not only did the judge not lock him up, but they didn't really treat him, they didn't really take a situation very seriously, and they didn't give him they didn't get him into a voluntary program.
Interesting.
I would not agree with that most of these folks want help. I think we're greatly over implying here that mental illness accounts for these behaviors. These people are certainly not pictures of mental health, but it isn't just a mental health issue in isolation. It's always mental health combined with an antisocial, narcissistic, entitled personality bend to self-soothe or self-gratify or self-avenge or whatever they feel entitled to do at the expense of innocent other people's lives. And so, maybe we can help them, maybe not. I don't really care about them as individuals as nearly as much as I care about the innocent people around who haven't done anything wrong, who are at risk. And so, particularly when somebody has already shown that they don't have any intention of following our laws and living peacefully among the rest of us, I think we ought to seize that opportunity to get them segregated from the rest of us, and if we can help them then fine, but the operative thing is to get them in a position where they're not able to do something like Sung Wee did at Virginia Tech.
All right, just to tell our audience, Brian, he's exactly right about
involuntary commitment. It's very brief. It's easy to get out of. All you have to do is say, oh, I don't really want to do anything serious, which is why I think when somebody's already broken the law is the time where we really have a chance to protect people, and we don't a lot of times.
Right. I just want to tell our audience that's Brian Russell, forensic psychologist and attorney from Lawrence, Kansas. And don't you think, Brian, though, that you would end up putting more people into custody who didn't need it and would really be upset by it than, you know, than actually finding people who you might prevent a crime with.
Yeah, I'll give you a perfect example. There was a guy here in my town just last week who shot up his own house. 911 call, a woman says, oh, he's shooting up the house. He's having a reaction to medication. The cops show up. They take him to the hospital, drop him off. He's already checked himself out, and no charges, not even discharging a firearm within the city limits because the cops are saying, well, you know, this was an unintentional firing of the weapon because the guy was hopped up on some kind of medication. No, you at least charge the guy because that's how we don't even know where the guy is now. We don't know if he's getting his medication issue straightened out. We don't know if he's getting mental health treatment. You charge the guy so that you can get a criminal court judge in his life who can say, you're going to treatment and I'll decide when you get out when you've got your medication issue straightened out. And you'll be back here several times over the next year for hearing and such like that. And if you want to say it was temporary insanity, then fine. Maybe if I buy that or if a jury buys that, you'll end up being acquitted. But for the meantime, I'm going to be involved in your life. The sheriff is going to your house to make sure you don't have any more guns.
Karen doesn't seem to think this is the great. We had a comment from the web, by the way, that says the government involuntarily putting people in treatment for trivial crimes may sound good, but anyone who doesn't get a chill down their back at even considering that hasn't been paying attention. That would be a massive change to our society. Karen, you wanted to jump in.
I 100% agree with that last comment. And I think it's to call people names, which is essentially what we're doing, using clinical names, but it's actually name calling. Call people psychopaths, narcissists, antisocial, and think that we are in some way getting to the root of the problem by that is ludicrous. That does not foster any type of understanding that would lead to better prevention.
Well, let me play devil's advocate, though. We're dealing with people who kill a lot of folks. Nothing else seems to have worked very well. We still have this epidemic of shooting. I think it's an epidemic. Maybe somebody disagrees with that. So you got to try something. What's wrong with trying this approach?
Well, again, it's not an epidemic if it's only 20 cases. We just seem to have a little cluster happening right now, whether it's copycat crimes. In some cases, it could be for whatever reason. It's an extremely, extremely rare phenomenon. And to solve it in that way would be like looking for a certain grain of sand on a beach.
Interesting. Okay. We're going to talk to Mas in San Jose. Good morning. You're on forum, Mas.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is going to be very quick. I'm kind of follow up, and I kind of really disappointed when people say that student. I'm a formal educated, and I'm quite aware of it. Kids who is lonely, or basically they have no social skills to other. I think as educators, maybe we should do as a society to involve, and those kids who've been lonely, and either they're at home and their family, they're not maybe the absentee in their life. And the educators who come to their life when they attended the college, maybe we make it a little bit a kind of a social interactive and engaged. I'm the last caller who was a nurse. I don't remember her name, unfortunately. She indicated that one of her students was some of the line from the classmate, and he was a straight A. However, he had a very, very lonely life. Unfortunately, as an educator, former educator, I have a student who are like that. And they have so many things that they've been isolated, and they have nowhere to go or nowhere to talk about it. Maybe we should, as an educator, we should have to take the time and make it our own schedule or office time and talk to these kids. And I will take my question off the air.
Okay, thank you. Karen, do you want to respond to that?
All right. No, I think she's just really right on. I really agree that a lot of the time that is something that could be done short of predicting anything bad that's going to happen. Is just reaching out and comforting a person who seems to be struggling and lonely or upset or depressed or what have you.
If I could jump in, this is David Eagleman. I think maybe I would take a middle position between where Brian and Karen are, which is that you know, it is terrific to help a kid. It's incredibly important if the kid is depressed, if we can talk to them, if there's something we can do to help them. But sort of reflecting Brian's position, some kids are really far out on the spectrum. They're deeply sociopathic. There's no amount of talking that's going to make them like you. There's no amount of reaching out and helping them that's going to make them care about other people or feel guilt or remorse. And if you combine that with other things like drugs and impulse control problems and so on, it's not really a solution. And so, I sort of want to echo Brian's point that once somebody has crossed the line and has proven that they are capable of doing antisocial behavior, it probably is important to go ahead and take action there. At the other end of the spectrum where you've got a kid who just needs someone to talk to, then, of course, that's critically important. But it's a nuanced issue because there's a spectrum.
Right. We have an email from Sue who says, these people need help before they get to the point where a crime is committed. My brother was drinking over a liter of alcohol every other day. I've been asking for help for more than a year. They said they couldn't do something unless he's a danger to himself or others. I mean, there are lots of stories like this, and it's a tough problem. There, we've got some other emails
can
as well.
Can I react to that?
Oh, yeah. Who's that?
This is Dave Cullen.
Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Here's my frustration with that and with certain parts of this conversation we've had is I think hit just a note that really gets me. It's like those people need help. These people, whatever. The problem discussions like this get a little muddied is, again, we're lumping them all together, and they come into much more clarity if you separate them into the different drives that are causing these. And I agree with a lot of what David has said, and I think it's much simpler if we sort of break the world. Okay, I give you three categories. I can make it even simpler. The people who want help and the people who don't want help. You know, those first categories who are either depressed, schizophrenic, there's something wrong with them, and they're having a deep problem, okay, and they want to get better.
And you get the last word on this because we are out of time. Thanks very much to Dave Cullen, the author of Columbine, who writes for the New York Times and Newsweek. Thanks to Ellen Servillon at Oikos University, Dave Eagleman from Houston, Texas, at Baylor College of Medicine, and Karen Franklin, a forensic psychologist at the California School of Professional Psychology, and Brian Russell, quite a cast, from Lawrence, Kansas. Anyway, thanks very much for listening to Forum. I'm Spencer Michaels, in for Michael Krasny. Stick around, there's more.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.